We have an incredible guest with us today, Bukata Hayes, the Vice President and Chief Equity Officer at Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota.
That's right, Bree. Bukata is responsible for driving Blue Cross's racial and health equity strategy, and his work focuses on embracing anti-racist values across the entire organization.
With over 20 years of experience in facilitating systemic change, Bukata's expertise spans nonprofit, education, and rural communities.
As a member of Blue Cross's senior leadership team, he's leading initiatives to address the specific needs of BIPOC members and communities.
Bukata also co-leads the Racial Equity Action Committee for Health, REACH, amplifying the voices of BIPOC employees and creating positive community impact.
And that's not all. He chairs the board of directors for the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota Foundation, furthering his dedication to fostering equity.
Wow. Did we get a good snapshot for the people, Bukata?
Yes. Yeah, you did.
Well, we're honored to have Bukata join us today. Let's dive into a powerful conversation about racism as a public health crisis and the impact on marginalized communities.
Let's get shaken.
Thank you. So today we are honored to have our very special guest joining us, Bukata Hayes. He's the Vice President of Racial and Health Equity and Chief Equity Officer at Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota. Welcome, Bukata.
Thank you, Bree. Thank you, Kelly. It's truly a pleasure to be here with both of you hosting this powerful discussion on such an important topic.
We're thrilled to have you here, Bukata. Before we delve into the heart of the matter, could you briefly tell our listeners about Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota and its commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Yeah, absolutely. So Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota is the largest nonprofit health plan in the state, right? In the state of Minnesota, we have about 2.5 million members across the country. And in essence, we're more than an insurance company, right? I mean, we're a health plan. And we're dedicated to fostering a culture of inclusivity, both within our organization and in the communities we serve. We recognize the power of diverse perspectives and the importance of supporting small, Black-owned and women-owned companies through different supplier diversity initiatives.
That's wonderful to hear. Can you share a bit about how sponsorships like this from Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota support and play a positive role in advancing supplier diversity and uplifting businesses like ours?
Well, you know, supply diversity is about where you spend your money, right? And so for us, we want to make sure that we are spending our dollars when we have the opportunity, right? And when we can sort of create these avenues to make sure that we're investing in Black-owned and women-owned companies to access new markets, to build new and valuable relationships, and to expand their reach, but also, in truth, expand ours. So by supporting these businesses, we believe we create a ripple effect of positive change, economic empowerment, and also, I would say, community empowerment, right? Because we understand when Black-owned and women-owned businesses are invested in, they also then return that investment into communities that they're living in. And so we believe it benefits all.
It really does. And it's just incredible. We appreciate Blue Cross Blue Shield's Minnesota's dedication to creating a more equitable future. And we appreciate you being a part of the conversation and for your support in making this possible.
It's my pleasure. Like, right. Between family, like we are, it's my pleasure. And I also want to just commend both of you for hosting this vital discussion on salt and pepper. Right. I love that name, too. So it's through these conversations that we know we can continue to inspire change, drive progress, and really make real, right, diversity, equity, and inclusion within our communities and our companies.
Yes, yes. So we're going to dive right into the conversation. We're going to start talking about how we can explore racism as a public health crisis. So I want to thank you, Bukata, for shedding light on the crucial role of sponsorships in advancing supplier diversity and supporting small Black and women-owned companies like ours. So now we're going to turn our attention to our topic of the day, racism as a public health crisis. And Kelly, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, I would really like to learn more about how that became so central to your efforts. Sure. You know, looking across the country since it's been a decade, right? Since Black Lives Matter showed up on Twitter, 3 years since the murder of George Floyd. And in the year following George Floyd's murder, two-thirds of the top U.S. companies made public statements, but really only 36% made financial contributions. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that it is central to your work and that it's not something that has waned for Blue Cross, mm-hmm. Blue Shield Minnesota, is so commendable, but also it's troubling to me in a way that it has done that in so many other mm-hmm. companies that can make transformative difference. So to get to my question, I guess I'm just kind of wondering how you see that commitment being transformative and why you chose to lead this effort.
Yeah. So I just, again, want to just thank you for this opportunity. So, being transparent, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, I'll just say Blue Cross from here forward. Blue Cross saw many things that were happening. So one, we're a Minnesota-centric organization. We are a one state blue plan. Right. That's the sort of terminology in our sector. We're a one state blue plan, deeply committed and connected to Minnesota. So we saw things happening in Minnesota. Right. And we responded. Right. The murder of George Floyd. Right. We were the epicenter for national and global protests and unrest. Right. Racial reckoning. So it was in that moment that Blue Cross decided that we were going to make the declaration that racism is a public health crisis and then commit to do something about it. So for me, I joined Blue Cross in 2021. It was after they made that commitment. And so they followed through on that in a couple of ways. One was they created a position in the hierarchy, right, to influence side to side with their peers, but also vertically, right, up and down. So they created a VP position, Vice President for Racial and Health Equity, which I now sit within. They also provided a team of folks, right? So it's not just an office of one, right? They provided a team of folks to do this work. So I have a team of about 23 or 24 folks that we partner with to impact a community and to advance racial and health equity in many ways. And then the last thing I'll say is they also provided dollars, right? And so it is through those three things, right? Leadership, right, within the organization, a team of folks who I get to partner with, and that then we partner across our enterprise, and then the dollars, right, the budget to support this really critical work. So that's how all of this came to be. And I think it's important that when we made that declaration of racism as a public health crisis, we were being responsive, right? And some might say, well, you weren't early to it, and you could have made this declaration a long time ago. Completely understand that, right? I put that on the table, right, for folks. But I would say we did, right? And there was a lot of folks who did not make that really public declaration that racism is a public health crisis. And we've tried to follow through on that, right, to make good on what we had declared and to be true to what we said on paper. And then I think the other thing was that at the same time, right, and we remember it back in 2020, 2021, and like we were in the midst of COVID. And so we saw real health impacts as well, life and death from COVID, in particular, how it impacted Black and Brown communities, right? Disproportionately, right? Higher rates of infection, higher rates of hospitalization, higher rates of death from COVID-19. And so all of those things, I think, were a pivot point for us as an enterprise. And we've been working to follow through on that, not to let up, to only really double down on our commitment to be there present in community and to address racism as a public health crisis and in many ways that it shows up. And I know we'll get an opportunity to talk about that.
Yeah. And I think that the highlight of COVID, as we know, exposed so many of the disenfranchisement impacts that are out there systemically, right, for people from marginalized communities. And, you know, when you start thinking about 22% of Black Americans got COVID, right, and 44% lost a job because of it, and 73% lacked the funds to cover, the emergency funds to cover that. So I think it does seem like this perfect fit, right, for you and Blue Cross to be furthering, because those things didn't just go away when COVID was declared over, right? There's residual impact of that that is catastrophic to what we want to do, which is build wealth and prosperity of people from marginalized communities.
So if I can add to that, Kelly, some alarming statistics, right? And I know that the COVID tracking project, it was a partnership between Ibram Kendi and his group and The Atlantic. And they were tracking COVID, right? And so what they found during some of that time is that Black folks were dying at 1.4 times the rate of everyone else, right? We also saw that at certain points within COVID, right, that because racism has showed up, in particular systemic racism has shown up in many ways throughout our country, like who was able to quarantine in place? Who was able to work from home? Who was able to, as a student, right, school from home? Like all of those things played a part. And like, so my hometown is Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And at one point in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, like 70%, I think, of all of the COVID deaths, in particular in Milwaukee, the city, were Black folks. And I know like all of the deaths in some of our other large communities, in particular urban communities like St. Louis and other places, like all of the deaths were Black and Brown folks. Right. And so this idea of how disproportionately COVID impacted, we know COVID was non-discriminatory in who could get it. But because discrimination had been in place for so long, right, it did sort of exacerbate the many longstanding racial inequities in our societies, right, that then led to really different outcomes, right, if you were Black or Brown, vis-a-vis if you were white.
You know, Bukata, I'm curious about what you feel empowers Blue Cross Blue Shield to be able to be so bold in their approach, right? That's coming from a lens of we've worked in these organizations where words like diversity, equity, inclusion are practically banned, right? So for you to have the ability to not just act on racism as a public health crisis, but actively act on it, what do you feel empowers your organization to do so?
So I would say probably a couple of things, right? So I do want to say, right, like we are as much a work in progress as any other sort of organization. We do have some things that we would say we are proud of, right, in terms of sort of showing commitment, dedication, follow through to this work, right? So I just want to lay that out there. But we are a work in progress as well. I would say a couple of things that that I think we believe is important. So one, again, we're a one state blue plan. And so we are centered on Minnesota, right? And so like the fact that these things have happened within our state, I think empowers us, right, to show up. I think the other thing is we're member centric, right? And so that's another piece that's important is that these things are impacting our members across the state, urban to rural, right? They are impacting our members. And so we're duty bound, right, to show up both for our state and for our members. And I think the other thing is that Blue Cross has a long history of working on social determinants of health, right? And for our listeners, that is this body of research. I became familiar with it through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that says 80% of a person's health is determined by factors outside of regular intervention with doctor or hospital or clinic, right? Outside of those walls and those interactions, that 80% of our health is determined by things such as housing and employment and habits, genetics and other things. And so for us, we've been doing a lot of work in that way. And so racism is clearly a social determinant of health, right? And I would say, that social determinant of health, or many of the social determinants of health, are impacted by racism, right? So if we think about how race has played a part in housing, how race has played a part in sort of access to medical care, to appropriate medical care, how racism has played a part in employment and economics and these other ways. And so because of those things, right, we're Minnesota-centric, we're member-centric, and then we have a long history of working on social determinants of health, and understanding the sort of vantage point of race and how it impacts those social determinants of health. I believe that's what allowed us to be bold, right? And to sort of stand on that declaration that racism is a public health crisis.
I threw the next question on the screen because got to it, right? So one of the questions we wanted to get into was, can you discuss the role of social determinants of health in perpetuating health disparities related to racism? And you shared so many of those in your answer. And it also gave me, it just jogs my memory. My family is from Gary, Indiana. And I think about contextually living in a community that's a steel mill community, right? Mm-hmm. We don't think about how that impacts the health and the trajectory of those living right in those dilapidated communities that are really at the bed and the foundation of a lot of the pollution, right? A lot of those negative societal and those carcinogens, a lot of the things that we know cause diabetes, that cause these health conditions that we see really being prevalent in Black and Brown communities, we can generally track, right? And so I think talk about social determinants and highlight what that means for our listeners. I think that's that important distinction.
Yeah. So when we mentioned the social determinants of health, right, we talked about the 80%, right? And actually some sort of updated research I've seen talks about almost 90% of our health is determined outside of sort of the context of a hospital clinic or your interactions with your doctor. But the social determinants of health. A couple of things I'll mention. So one, I just want to tell a story quickly about as I was coming through college, right? Because it gets to this idea of those social determinants and sort of how that impacts health. And there's some great work by David R. Williams in his TED Talk, Racism Makes Us Sick, right? That I can refer to a little bit too. So coming through, finishing up college, in a class, my degree is in exercise physiology, so a preventable sort of discipline, right, in terms of healthcare. And we're in a class, we're talking about the risk factors for heart disease, right? And so we go through the things you would typically see, smoking, right, excessive drinking, sedentary lifestyle, obesity. And then on the screen, right, as it's being presented, the word Black. And then it goes to the next one, right? High cholesterol, right? Eating habits, those sorts of things. So I remember sort of raising my hand and asking the question, hey, can you explain more? It just said Black. And the professor was like, yeah, right now, if you are Black, right? This was back in 1997, 1998, just to give listeners a time period, a frame for it. This is back in that time. The professor said, if you're Black, you have a higher risk for heart disease. Right. That's what the research is showing at the time. Well, what we now know. Right. And I remember sitting with that answer, like, are you kidding me? Just being Black. Right. Like. And so then what we now know. Right. And this goes to those social determinants of health and how the accumulation of those impact actual physical health. We now know that folks living under really high stress, that at each moment encounter stressful sort of distress, that really high levels of stress, it actually has physiological impacts on health. High blood pressure, right? Initiation or making you more vulnerable to sickness and some other things. And so I want you to think about like living, right, in a really suffocatingly racist environment, right? And the high stress that causes a body to respond to, right? Like now we know it's that causes health, like I would say detrimental health outcomes is not just being Black, right? And so we're continuing to find some of that research and then the social determinants of health. You talked about Gary, Indiana. I said my hometown is Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, one of those social determinants of health is housing and sort of environmental aspects of that. So North Side community, right, bifurcated by Interstate 43, which goes from Milwaukee to Green Bay, split the Black community, right? So all the housing, the community, the wealth that had been built up at that time was sort of dissipated, decimated within Milwaukee on the North Side. If we know Minnesota, we particularly know the metro, We know that was another experience that, right? Rondo.
Yeah.
Right? 94, going through a vibrant Black community. And now we see the after effects of that. That's one of those social determinants of health, housing mm-hmm. and access to housing, the environmental things, the pollutants that just are in the air. We also know that if you live next to, garbage waste mm-hmm. area, right? A landfill, right? Like that also has detrimental health outcomes. We see the river, right? That's been polluted by manufacturing, right? That we're now trying to get a better handle on, right? We understand that had detrimental impacts on health. And so Flint, Michigan, right? Like that's another sort of social determinant of health. And so it's really important that we understand no social determinants of health, right? They are like everything that we do throughout a day, right? Like every day that we walk, right, in this country, social determinants of health impact how we feel, how our body responds, and what our health outcomes will be, right? Housing, education, employment, like all of those things. And so that large body of work, social determinants of health, I think really important. And I think if we truly believe that body of research, right, Bree and Kelly, that salt and pepper, right, that if we truly believe that research, then we should be investing more in those areas, right? If we know that they provide beneficial health outcomes, if we know the absence of those begets us detrimental outcomes, then the presence of those, right, should provide better health outcomes. And that's why we've been deeply committed as a health plan and as an organization, as an enterprise, to addressing social determinants of health, and in particular, how we know racism plays a part into that. In particular, where do you live? How many folks live where you live, right? Do you have the proper access to water, broadband, internet, all of those sorts of things?
You know, in King County in the state of Washington, the Gathering Collaborative and the county itself, maybe inspired by Blue Cross, created a $25 million grant fund to combat racism as a public health crisis. Same exact premise. Yeah. Yep. Their focus being on Black Americans and Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. And the reasons that they put out about that were all about the systemic racism in the United States that is precluding Black and Indigenous people from being healthy. You know, and when I hear you talk about the social determinants of health, those are controlled by a system mm-hmm. and in many ways controlled and perpetuated to disenfranchise mm-hmm. Black and Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. Black and brown people, right? So we put people in a certain place. We make it possible for you to live only in a certain place. We mm-hmm. want to keep you from being part of management or, you know, mm-hmm. create that concrete ceiling for people of color versus the glass ceiling for women. And these systems are disguised to some extent. When you talked about the class where you sat there and Black came up as a factor, well, mm-hmm. it isn't because you're Black. It's because the system has disenfranchised you as Black people and kept you from having access to things that would help you be healthy. You know, so
yeah,
I think money is really important. Broad-based commitment like you have from a powerful organization is important. Mm-hmm. But what else can we do systemically?
Yeah.
To better change those roadblocks and the systemic barriers. Mm-hmm. Because it sometimes feels so big.
Yeah. So I would say, I think that's a great question. That's one that we've been wrestling with. I think about how you change systems, right? So one, I want to say, as we declared racism a public health crisis, and for listeners, like we meant that as the broad systemic racism, right? We absolutely understand individual encounters of racism impact health as well. Right. And are detrimental to health, maybe detrimental to jobs and right. Economic security. And we also know that there's a larger system at play. Right. So while the word systemic racism doesn't appear in that declaration. It is absolutely inherent and embedded in that, right? So when we talk about how we do this work, so one of the things that I think about in terms of systems is, and there's a graphic out there about the levers of change, and it uses the iceberg analogy, right? And it says on the waterline is events. And then when you go under the waterline, right, the system, it's patterns of behavior, it's structures, and then it's mindsets. Mm-hmm. Right. And so how do you continue to sort of be clear eyed about the patterns of behavior, the structures and the mindsets that allow certain events to happen above the surface? So if it was the, so if it is the murder of George Floyd, right? Remember, folks all of a sudden start asking, like, how could some of this, how could we allow some of this to happen? And all of a sudden we started going underneath the surface. What is the patterns of behavior? Whoa. Well, we found out that in particular in Minneapolis, right? And if it was around policing, if it was around economics, if it was around housing, that there was these patterns of behavior with Black folks, mm-hmm. right? Vis-a-vis either police department or housing or economics, right? That were at play. And then if you go to structures, right? You say, so what are those structures? Well, of course, there's these structures that as far as education, right? Mm-hmm. That we know were providing or the outcomes where Black and Brown folks were graduating at a lower rate, right? Mm-hmm. Not only for Minnesota, but like we lead the country in graduating Black and Brown high. We lead the country in not graduating Black and Brown high school students. And then the mindsets, right? So what mindsets are at play that allow us to have structures that are inaccessible, patterns of behavior that perpetuate inequities, and then these events that continue to reoccur. And so part of what I would encourage listeners to do is to do that really really heavy work. That's a lot of labor to try and get underneath and not just respond to events, not just respond to incidents, but to say, what really can we do? Like, what are those things that are allowing these incidents and events to continue to happen? And let's work on that. And so that's what we've committed to, in particular in sort of the department I lead, racial and health equity, is how do we begin to look at patterns of behaviors, structures, and mindsets, and like make sure our work is addressing those three really large levers as we think about projects, as we think about partnerships, as we think about initiatives, right? So our conversation here today is aimed at mindsets, yes. right? It's aimed at sort of providing this information to folks that we can begin to work on mindsets, chip away at some of these things that we know then show up in how structures are created, the patterns of behavior we engage in, and then the events that those things provide us, right? So I think those are some of the things that I would say. I would say too, right? You know how both of you understand systems change work mm-hmm. is long, right? Is not instant gratification, right? It's small wins on top of small wins on top of small wins. It's progress over perfection. And so I know a lot of us who have been in this work, the three of us, right, in this conversation have been in this work for a long time. And we know that there's some folks who are now sort of coming to the work. And I think it's important that we say, hey, this is not short-term work. Mm-hmm. Simply sort of raising something to the surface doesn't change it. Calling it out doesn't change it. Then it takes work after that, right? And so, like, be ready for the long-term work, because if you aren't, what I've seen, and I don't know about both of you, but what I've seen is that if you aren't ready for the long-term work, you quickly find an off-ramp. Mm-hmm. Things get too rough. So,
you know, I think about this term illusion of inclusion, right? And how organizations so often get caught up in this illusion of inclusion that happens when you want to do the shiny red apple approach, right? You want it to look like diversity from the outside in, but when you get into the core, it's really rotten. You're not really working on diversity from the inside out. And so that illusion of inclusion is like a hamster in a wheel, right? You're really embracing the idea as an organization, but you're not really being about the action that it requires to make systemic change. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so I think that's so. I think that is spot on. So one of the things that we've done right at Blue Cross is we've brought DEIB, so diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, which is as an internal focus, right, into sort of the RHE team, racial and health equity, which has this sort of community external focus, sort of outcome driven. But the idea was to more directly align those two. So the work that we're doing internally, right, supports and feeds into the work that we're doing externally, and vice versa, right? That like, as we are out in community, as we are doing this work externally with members in the community, we learn things that we bring back in that then we do internally. Like our house must be in order, right? Like we are trying to manifest things externally that we are living internally. And I think to your point, Bree, that the idea of like, are you doing both becomes super critical. I think you can't be successful, honestly. I don't believe any company has been successful doing one or the other, right? Because if you're doing one or the other, you're doing all this work externally, but Black and brown folks are leaving your enterprise, right? You don't have good representation across your enterprise, then like, you're not being successful. You lose out on talent. You lose out on sort of expertise and brilliance that could have influenced how you were showing up externally. You lose out on networks, right? And connections. So we are trying to sort of, we are, I would say, doing both of those and trying to be authentic to both of those to get to our goals and priorities as a team.
One of the things I like about what you said too is the whole idea of what comes to my mind. I won't put words in your mouth. What comes to my mind is this self-responsibility that we all have. And especially as I talk to or reach out to white listeners that might be out there, you know, the phrase behind me is if you permit it, you promote it. So thinking about what you can do within your own sphere of influence, and then how far reaching can you be with that work? And it starts with yourself, like you said, to look internally at yourself, whether you're an individual or an organization, to check. I try to check myself all the time. Bree helps me out with that. And then just thinking about how to leverage what you have to further what you can do. And same with service learning or volunteerism. You know, there's like this zeal to do something yourself, but then there's this point at which you want to make system change, you know, and there is that wall where you say, oh, I can't really make that kind of change. And yet it's going to take all of us to make it, you know, it's going to take money. It's going to take people who are courageous, like Blue Cross, to say, we're going to put this out there. We know we might, you know, upset the apple cart that doesn't like it. But we saw that with, you know, post George Floyd, we saw this rush to be supportive and be on board with BLM. And then soon when it politically became unpopular and you might lose some customers, this big retraction of support. So it was market driven rather than being systemically required.
Yeah. So you bring up a great point, right? I think about and again, being in the work for a while, you understand that progress is followed by regress or repression, right? So that's what we saw, right? This huge movement, right? To say, we want to center Black and brown voice, right? We want to be more intentional about how that looks and feels, right? We understand it's been something that has hampered, really crippled our nation for a long time. So some real progress. And I think we saw that. And at the same time, and even now more prominently, we see this regression or what may be repressive measures that we now see folks are trying to take, right? That says you can't teach DEI, right? We know that certain places across this country, in particular in higher ed, are saying you can't have state dollars to support diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, departments, faculty, right, on your campus, right? And like these other things that now, right, looking at businesses, right, who are impacted by that. And I did want to say that I think important that we that we talk about in Blue Cross. We talk about this idea of truth and reconciliation, right? And so my framing way before that, right? We understand it was a process, and it was prevalent in South Africa, moving from apartheid to more sort of inclusive community. We understand it also has deep roots within indigenous communities, as well as sort of African communities, right? And we talk about it, and the framing I use is again from Bryan Stevenson around truth and reconciliation is a sequential process, right? Truth and reconciliation is a sequential process, meaning we have to engage in truth first, right? And so we're trying to do that too at Blue Cross. We're trying to engage in truth about how is healthcare, what role is healthcare played in the disparities and inequities that we see today, right? What role has health plans played in sort of accessible sort of thresholds for healthcare, right? And then the idea of reconciliation, I mean, truth first, reconciliation then next, the idea that like we have to engage in that as an organization, as we engage outwardly, so that we understand, right, that there are some communities who have valid reasons to distrust us. And we have to be willing to sit there, be highly sort of attuned to that, listen, right, as communities say, hey, man, this is what happened. Every time I tried to engage with you, this is what happened. Here's what you did to people I know, right? And we have to sit there, right? We have to sort of hear that, wrestle with it, and stay present, right? And so we're doing that same process, right?
You say, here's what you did to people I know. And I think about this comedian, a melanin recessive comedian, who was sharing how white people must have felt on Juneteenth. And even though he used it in this comedic way, I think it was representative of the fear that melanin recessive people feel, the true fear that they forecasted for if only people treated our population the way our population has by and large historically treated others, right? And so that fear begins to manifest itself in a very real and protective way, protective over their resources, protective over their property. When we talk about redlining and the impact of social determinants like housing, we think about the fear that must have been in someone's mind to make them create a policy where when you look at the way some of these homes are deeded, some went to great extent to say, I will never sell this home or this land to a Black person, to a person of color. And so when we talk about that fear and how it manifests itself, I think, in racism, but also in racism as a public health crisis, that's just one example that I can think of for, I wouldn't say a rationale, but where we think about how lived and how true that can be for a poor melanin recessive person's experience.
So to that point, Bree, right, we know, right, and Dr. King, right, made this real as he would talk about, right, racism, right, absolutely has impacts on the person it's targeted at. But like this implicit, this hidden impact it has on those who are the beneficiaries or those who are sort of directing that is that it does something to you, too. To your moral conscience, right? It does something to your psyche, right? That would allow you to see someone as non-human, like all of these things. And so to the point of the fear, if you know, and I think that's what we see a lot right now, right? With some of the new policies and legislation folks are trying to sort of have implement and be real is if you know that historically, like, a group that you belong to have perpetuated such harms, right? Your fear is that if someone else was in power, they would do the same thing, right? And I think that's and to your point, not trying to give it rationale, but I do think we have to continually be cognizant of that because that is a barrier for some of our white colleagues who could be allies or co-conspirators to get beyond, yep. Right? That Well, if you're empowered, you're just going to do the same thing to me that I did to you. And that's not it. Right.
Right.
So I think that's a really important piece you bring up, because that fear does stop folks from engaging, or it propels folks to further exclude. Right. To try and figure out a way to never have a change in power happen.
So one of the things you said with this, like, implicit racism, like this emotional tax, I never thought of it being a two-way street. And it makes me wonder if you would agree that epigenetic trauma goes both ways, right? So when we think about the history of this country, there's this duality that we have to live in, where we have to have this dual consciousness for this topic of epigenetic trauma, and say, just as much as racism is hurting communities of color, it's also, as a byproduct, hurting melanin recessive communities also, because whenever we can't have that melding, right? When we're not, you know, this salad bowl of identities and everyone lives in their differences, when you have one person hurt within the ecosystem of a community, then there's a residual impact. And I think it's very important to talk a little bit or highlight a little bit more about that if you can.
Yeah. So epigenetics. I think about how, you know, I'll speak from the community I'm from, right, that I'm a part of, and that's the Black community. And, you know, the Black community for a long time would talk about how, right, sort of these memories, these experiences were passed down. Like, how did we all understand this, right? From my great grandmama to my grandmama to my mama to me, like how did this, like, you know, how did that get passed down? Right? Was it simply this byproduct of storytelling and sort of experience and some other things? And to your point, epigenetics says no, right? There's some literal DNA markers that are changed, that are altered, that reflect that trauma that is passed down from mother, right, to offspring. And so, yes, that's new research that shows that trauma passes through, right, from one generation to the next. And so to your point of could that same sort of injury, right, because we know that's injurious to both us as communities of color and to white communities, right? So could that injury, trauma, be passed down both ways? I would probably agree with you, right? That there's been things passed down to white society, right, through all of this, that absolutely has been injurious, and that is trauma within white communities that doesn't allow them to see communities of color as fully human, mm-hmm, in certain instances, mm-hmm, right? That, like, just blocks that ability to, yes, see as fully human as we are. And so, yeah, I mean, yes, I think you raise a great point there in terms of sort of how it has impacted us all, and how that has sort of been passed down, not simply in a cultural way of being, but in a sort of physiological way of existing as well.
Thank you for that, Kelly. We have probably time for one more question. Do you have anything burning that you wanted to ask?
I'd throw it to you, Bakata. Do you have anything burning we didn't cover? I mean, I think that this podcast, your insight and your wisdom, this discussion is just such a great educational opportunity for anyone who listens to it. I am sure that there will be higher ed classes and other people who take advantage of it. So anything you wanted to add that you don't think we covered or bring up, that would be great.
I have a question, Kelly.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to make sure we gave Kelly an opportunity to join in the conversation. But in lieu of one, I really wanted to make sure we had the time to talk about community organizations and how grassroots movements contribute to dismantling systemic racism, promoting health equity, and how your work can, how it intersects or engages with those organizations on the front lines to make sure this work transcends into the communities.
Yeah. So we believe some of our core beliefs, right? So as we talk about it across the enterprise, our core beliefs in racial and health equity, racism is a public health crisis, is one of our core beliefs. The next one is community has the answers, right? The next one is be bold and be different. And then the last one is a shared liberation, right? This idea of Blue Cross will be liberated when we eliminate racial and health inequities, and community will be liberated when we eliminate racial and health inequities, right? So this idea that, and I'll speak to the community has the answers. So for us, we believe community, because they've existed and persisted through inequities, they've figured out ways, right, without our help as an enterprise, to persist and sustain, to overcome, truthfully. And so how do we simply listen, learn, partner, and act, right, with community? And so when I think about community organizations, I think about we have a deep desire to make sure we are listening, right, make sure we are learning, partnering, and then acting. And that acting could be simply an influence. It could be in presence. We also know it could be finances, right? So one of the ways in which we have, one of the ways that systemic racism shows up is Black-led, women-led, BIPOC-led organizations historically have been divested from and not invested in the dollars to do the work, the dollars to have impact. And so we're trying to make sure that we show up in all of those ways, right? Influence, presence, and financially, right? To invest in community organizations that have been doing this work, that are willing to partner with us, right? Because they have answers to what ails their community. And through their working in their community and other folks working in their community, we find these really, I believe, broad-based solutions that will change and transform our state. And then the thing that the two around shared liberation, we work off of and try and answer two what we call philosophical sort of implications and questions. And so when we talk about shared liberation, we talk about one, how would community look and feel, right, if they didn't have to deal with racial and health inequities, right? How would community look and feel, right, if we had eliminated racial and health inequities? And then the other piece is, in essence, what does liberation look like and feel like for Blue Cross as an enterprise if we aren't having to, right, work on racial and health inequities, if we aren't having to try and move this large mountain of work around historical racism and inequities, right? We're having to sort of do this backfill of work to even reach a point of threshold, right? Because there's been a long history, right, of inequity. So those are the two sort of philosophical things we wrestle with as we do this work. What would liberation look like for communities, and what would liberation look and feel like for us as an enterprise? And I think that goes to the question around community and community organizations, and how I think enterprises like ours have an opportunity to show up and to partner in a way that truly moves community and thus our state forward.
Oh, you're muted.
Well, as we near the end of this eye-opening episode, to our listeners, we really want to leave you with some actionable insights and a call to action. And with Bukata, while we still have you and your expertise, what last advice or recommendations do you have for individuals who want to take action and contribute to addressing racism as a public health crisis in their own communities? And I think you just kind of shed a little light on that. But if you want to just give them maybe one or two from day one when you sit back in your seat, what are some tangible takeaways that you hope they can put into action immediately?
Yeah. So one is a bigger frame framing, and that is we often get the response that, like, where do you start, right? And so, and then it's just so big, right? That how can I have impact? So I take some insight from Ibram Kendi, right? Author of stamped from the beginning, the definitive history of racist ideas, and also how to be an anti-racist. And so, but in Stamped from the Beginning, he goes through this long book, and if you read it, you know, voluminous in terms of the way that he outlines how race has impacted our country and its policies, procedures, interactions. And then in the epilogue, he talks about that the most effective anti-racist efforts, he calls them protests, efforts, are fiercely local. And that these fiercely local efforts connect with other fiercely local efforts, and we sort of amplify, right, our work and our impact together. And I think that's the one piece of, that's the first piece of advice, and that is to start where you're at, right? Don't think, how am I going to change Minneapolis? How am I going to change Gary, Indiana? How am I going to change Milwaukee, Wisconsin? I would say, think about, how am I going to change my circle? How am I going to change my neighborhood? And I think that you begin to see with, I think, more clarity that here's opportunities I could do. It could be around housing stability. It could be around food insecurity. It could be around those who are newly replanted within community after being incarcerated. It could be a number of things that you do, right, that allow you to address and provide solutions that are fiercely local for your community. And then the other thing that I would say, and we said it earlier, this is long-term work. And so I have resigned myself, and I know many in this work have, that like, I won't physically see the end of this. I won't physically see like the impact, the immense and wonderful impact that all of our work will have, but I'm committed to doing my part, doing all I can while I can, right, to get us closer. I have four kids, three boys and a baby girl. Y'all know that. Mm-hmm. I am not trying to have them inherit the same thing I inherited, in particular when it comes to racial and health inequities. And so that's the other thing. It's like, this mm-hmm. is long-term work. It's difficult work. And if you believe, right, in sort of a, and I'll say it this way, in a narcissistic way, that like, I'm going to be that person, right? Mm-hmm. I think that creates, and I think that's problematic, right? Because there is so much that has to be done, and we do our stuff in our own way, but like, it's long-term work. And so I know my father, he's mid-70s. He was doing this work since he was in his 20s. And, you know, he's not going to see when we finally arrive at this place. I'm probably not going to see when we eventually arrive at this place, but I think we are grounded in the fact that we're doing something that helps us to get there. And I think that's really important, because y'all know folks can easily get disenfranchised. They can easily get sort of cynical and say, well, whatever. Right. And I'm saying, like, in long-term work, you don't have much time to be cynical. Right. You got to understand every little bit we're doing goes to help change the trajectory of our communities. And hopefully, right, create something that we have never seen. Mm-hmm. And that is a truly equitable and racially just society.
Wow. Well, before we wrap up this empowering episode, we want to make sure we extend a special shout out to our incredible series presenting sponsor, Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota. With your support, we can continue bringing you essential conversation like today's, impacting communities far and wide. So we want to extend our biggest thank you for you sharing all of your knowledge, your wealth of experience, but also for you all being a champion for this work and understanding that the marathon really continues, right? And that we are really at the beginning of the race. We're not at the middle. We're not really at the end. And as we think about our individual dash, the work that we do between our sunrise and sunset on this earth, like you said, if you're doing it for yourself, you've already lost kind of that purpose. What we're really having to understand is we're doing it for the generations that are coming after us so that they don't have to inherit, as you said, the conditions that we've all had to inherit.
What you had to say not only was educational and thought-provoking, but I think it can cause us all to feel aspirational about our own role and what we can do. And while, like you said, we can't narcissistically think that we can do it all, we still have to do something. Mm-hmm. So knowing how we can leverage our influence and our ability to make change, and then taking action to do so, is what we hope everyone will do after listening to you and to all of the ideas that were thrown out here.
Yeah. So I would say thank you for having me on. I deeply, deeply appreciate it. I want to also just acknowledge all of the real work that both of you do, right? Like for folks who are listening, they may think that you're solely amazing podcast hosts, but they that doesn't fully encompass, right, all of the amazing work that both of you do day in and day out, right, within your community, within your institutions. And so I want to make sure that y'all get y'all flowers, right? Okay. Because y'all are doing incredible work. This is a small piece of that. Outside of this, you are heroes. And I think it's important that that you hear that, that you acknowledge for it. And again, so just thank you for having me on. Important conversation, really critical work, courageous work, brave work, brave labor that we are all engaged in.
Thank you so much. Well, we think the conversation is just at the beginning. We've had so many excited to participate. And so we are excited to our next episode that we'll be doing right after this actually is going to be with an assistant professor who is in speech language pathology and really looking at that early literacy aspect, the impact of having the right resources in the right communities at the right time, and really expanding the health equity conversation beyond healthcare and looking at universal inclusion and saying, what we really hope to do at all times is look at the most marginalized person within any space and work our way outward. So be that your community clinic, be that your school, be that your classroom, be that your office, universal inclusion requires that each of us take our unique piece of the puzzle and decide what we're uniquely positioned to do to make change.
Mm-hmm. Well, sounds like a great episode. I can't wait to hear it.
Awesome. Well, thank you. We will let you go so that we can take these last few minutes to prep before we get into our next one. Lovely speaking with both of you guys and recording. So excited for everyone to get to hear this conversation. And thank you again for joining us today.
You're welcome.